Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
I am so excited that for 2024, Your Brand Amplified is proudly sponsored by one of my favorite platforms, Simplified. This AI-driven platform is a game changer for design and video content. With Simplified, I can effortlessly transform lengthy videos, such as my podcast, into engaging, shareable clips and streamline workflows with an intuitive subtitle generator. For designers out there, you can explore the AI-powered image generator, create compelling presentations, and design eye-catching YouTube thumbnails with ease. Revolutionize your creative process at Simplified.com with a free trial. Now let's dive into today's guest.
Welcome to Your Brand Amplified, the podcast where we interview marketers, publicists, and brands to learn their stories, what makes them tick, and tips and tricks that make a difference.
This is Annika Jackson with Your Brand Amplified, and it's my genuine pleasure to have Joseph Karabas with us today. Joseph, you have such an amazing and interesting background. I know we're going to talk a lot about the books that you write and being an author and how that's been such a big passion for you since you were little. But I first want to welcome you to the show and say, I see you went from software analyst to professor to neuromarketer to patent holder. We have a lot of things in common with USC Annenberg and some of the things that you've done there and the fact that I'm now a professor there. And now you've retired from all of this whole amazing career, and you're infusing people with your joy of writing. So
I hope so.
I'm excited to unpack. We could probably speak for hours, but we have, a finite amount of time. So welcome. And if you don't mind starting with your journey, I'd love to hear how you went through your different stages of your career and how that all of these different things that are somewhat connected, but also somewhat disparate, how you connected them.
Well, thank you for having me. Excellent question. I think how it all started was I was never satisfied with a single track. It's not to say that I was driven by kismet and serendipity, but I was kind of like a crow. Oh, that's bright and shiny. Ooh, that's bright and shiny. Oh, that's bright and shiny. So I attempted college 3 times. I never succeeded. I never graduated. I often tell people I'm still in school, and if I'm lucky, I might get out alive. Lifelong learner. Along the way, if you're willing to just follow the flow, so to speak, some amazing things can happen. I never graduated college. I went 3 times, never graduated. I've taught at the university level. I've had one of my books was adopted as a college textbook.
Wow.
It's a great thing to have happen. And that wasn't something I planned. They just, can you write this book? I said, yeah, sure, I'll give it. Yeah, well, okay, fine. Next thing I know, the publisher says, hey, good news. Okay, what? Yeah. And it was actually a university in Japan. I can't remember the exact university, but they adopted it first.
Oh.
And then it just went all over the globe, which is a nice gig if you can get it, let me tell you. But, the reason I didn't do well in school was, when I was in school, we're talking about the 1970s, they wanted you to follow a track. You're going to be on the engineering track. You're going to be on the history track. And here's the courses you want to take. Well, I was on the physics track, mathematics and physics, but there was an awful lot of philosophy that fascinated me, And there was an awful lot of history and economics. That's interesting, too. So as one of the deans said to me at one point, when are you going to decide what you want to do with your life? And I said, never if I'm lucky. I think people who follow that linear life path, that's wonderful. Didn't work for me.
Yeah.
So I didn't get a degree in physics, but I worked for NASA as an analyst. The reason being, for whatever reason, I was very adept at looking, literally looking at a long stream of data coming from the satellites and knowing what it meant without having to use the interpretive software that we had at the time. Amusing story about that, if I may.
Yes, please.
We were collecting data off a bunch of the weather satellites. This is the 1970s. And the satellites were, back then, they would report in every 15 minutes what they were observing. And of course, it was like, oh, like you get now, dot, 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 dot. So one of the satellite feeds reported that the Earth had no atmosphere for 15 minutes. It was a malfunction.
Right.
All the PhDs in the room, they're going, oh my God, what does this mean? Oh my, what, I don't. And I'm looking at these well-degreed, well-educated people, and I went, guys, we're still breathing. There's still an atmosphere. I think the satellite screwed up. Oh, yeah. And that kind of convinced me right then and there that you don't need a PhD to make mistakes. You can just do it on your own, which I did. I was never afraid of making mistakes. I was never afraid of looking foolish. I was never afraid of asking questions, which that slows a lot of people down. Mm-hmm. They don't want to appear foolish. They want to, you know, whatever. And not me. How does that work? How do you do that? Come explain that to me. So I, at the end of the 1980s now, I discovered I had a knack for software development. Who knew? And that led me in the 1990s to create a technology literally in my basement.
Wow.
And I thought it was very interesting because I put together a technology, a software technology, which existed on a laptop, could work on any computer, not any programmable device, but I put it on a laptop so I could carry it around and demonstrate it. And the U.S. Patent and Trade Office, this was not something we said. This was something they said. But we couldn't have asked for better marketing. They said the name of the company that we created was Next Stage Evolution. And they said, Next Stage Evolution has created a technology that can understand and respond to human thought through any human-machine interface. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Worked on a laptop. And we're talking like a 286 laptop, not these high-power things you have today. But the only problem was back then, you know, I'd go to companies and say, we can help you figure out how your customers are thinking while they're on your website. And they would say, why do I care what my customers think?
Oh my gosh.
Okay. The funny thing was, Europe, other parts of the world, they took it like this, you know, boom. Because they're used to having to think German, having to think Chinese, having to think Laotian, you know, Laotian. How to think Australian, right? How to think English, how to think Denmark. They're used to, you know, I have to get inside the customer's head to know how to market to them.
Yeah.
The United States, yeah. Raw.
Right.
No.
This is
white bread.
This is our product. This is why it's great. Here you go. Accept it. Yeah.
Yeah. To create that technology, I independently studied anthropology, advanced mathematics, neuroscience. Somebody who worked for us actually counted the different disciplines that I literally strung together. So, you know, you have 120 different disciplines. And I said, well, all I did was I would find something in quantum mechanics. I need that piece. Put it in. I would find something in virology. My wife was a immunologist at the time, and she would talk to me about what she was doing. And I'd go, there's an equation for that. Well, we don't know what it is. I can figure it out. Put it in.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was not a boom, here it is, block. It was very much a meld of things. Got the patents, ran the company. Whatever you do, never start a company and have it be successful. It's a headache. It's more than you want to deal with. In 2016, we decided, because Susan, my wife, partner, and Princess, and I, we managed the company together. We decided we wanted to quit, get out of it. Susan said, I've never seen you happier than when you've been writing your stories. I want you to do that the rest of your life.
I'm off. I love that.
And I went, shucks, darn, bummer. Ooh, and here we are.
Wow. So you sold the company?
We gave parts of it away.
Yeah.
You know, to different institutions, different agencies, different groups. Cool. They were using pieces and parts of it.
Yeah. That's just amazing. I mean, I feel like every single day when I teach class or even when I'm speaking to clients for marketing agency work, what you created is what we use every day. You can't just have the demographics. You have to have the psychographics. And then you figure out what the commonalities are between the different stakeholders. And then that's the through line to create your messaging and your advertising and your marketing and your PR strategies and all of that. And I think the only way you could create something like that is to have a mind like yours, where, you know, I think today they would say maybe ADHD or like some other neurodivergencies and things like that, right? And
yes.
But that is the apex of creation in so many ways.
Yeah, it is. And thank you for, you know, mentioning neurodiversity. Yes, I was neurodiverse before I had a term.
Right.
You know, I was pioneered yet another one, Joseph. But yeah, you genuinely look at the great discoveries. Now, I'm not saying I'm a great discoverer, but I'm saying looking at the breakthrough things in science throughout the ages, Einstein was actually a very diversified student. He didn't do good in school, but he studied a lot of different things.
Yeah.
You know, and read his work and, you know, theory of relativity has as much to based on philosophy as it is on physics. You know, for someone to say, what if I'm standing still and the universe is moving around me? Well, that was the ancient Greek philosophy, right? The earth was the center of the universe. So he went back to their philosophy and went, okay, but we do know the earth is moving. So how can I be the relative center? And, you know, oh, it's not something moving through space. It's something moving through time. Now we have time-space continuum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no field has, and this is one of the concerns when I talk to college audiences now, I will say to them, spend as much time studying history, studying language, you know, don't be purely science because you lose the ability to expand your thinking. You have to learn to think out of the box or you just won't be creative. Imagination is so much more powerful than anything else. I'm sure we both have known students, we've known people in school, we've known peers who they knew the book. By God, they aced the exams. They were good students, but they couldn't think to either side. You get them an inch either side of their field, they're lost. I couldn't, you know, I've got to go about exploring.
Yeah. And that's, there is definitely a push-pull. And first of all, saying, no, there's nothing you could say could bore me because my father was one of the most brilliant men that I'd ever known. Very high IQ. He was a philosophy professor, but he was also very multifaceted and he was always studying other philosophies, studying eight languages at a time, studying so many different things. So that's, I grew up in that context of sitting in the car, making an offhanded comment, and he'd say, that reminds me of Nietzsche, or what do you think Socrates would think about this? And so we had these discourses, and I also now have a daughter who's in high school who already, she's 15, she's known since she was 12 that she's going to get a PhD in neuroscience and study brain anomalies. And she, what she's going to study changes, but she's so passionate, and she's read so many books by prominent neuroscientists, and you know, she knows her path. And so I love having these conversations with her because it reminds me of my father, and that the conversation we're having and what you're sharing right now reminds me of that. And it's a very warm and fuzzy and great space to be in, right?
Definitely.
But I do think, because I also have some neurodivergencies and I've almost always been either an entrepreneur, or marketing, PR, in some facet, philanthropy, but what I've done is very different. And so there have been times when I said, oh, I should just go get a job now. And it's hard to find a job that wants somebody like that, right? Because because a lot of careers are, you're a specialist in SEO, you're a specialist in this, you're a specialist in this. And what we train our students though now in these programs is you have to know a little bit about everything. You might specialize, but if you have to know how to work well with all the other teams, or at least bring enough to the table that you can say, okay, how are we integrating all these strategies? Is this really mapping back to the philosophy, the values of our company, but also to the customer, the end user that we want to experience what we do.
Yes, exactly. You know, you mentioned your dad studying eight languages at once. It's different now, but when I was growing up, going through school, you definitely had English. It was your native language. And maybe you studied another one. This may be an unpopular thought, but bear with me for a second. I am strongly in favor of a national language, mm-hmm. one language. Mm-hmm. However, right on top of that is, I think being bilingual, multilingual is a must. We must learn, because I was raised until I was five speaking Italian, Sicilian dialect Italian. And it's kind of funny because I don't have an accent now. However, when I talk with my sister, Susan, my wife will say, you know, I didn't know a word you guys were saying. It's, we'll speak a pidgin.
Right.
You know? And one of the things I have, I've studied German and I've studied French, Gaelic, which is a wonderful language, and also American Sign Language.
Yeah.
I find that when I'm trying to solve a problem, I can draw on all of these cultures. And an interesting or an amusing anecdote here. When Susan and I were learning Gaelic, Scots Gaelic, there was a point where I couldn't think of the word in Gaelic. And, you know, the teacher was just waiting for me to come up with the word. And I turned to Susan and I said the equivalent concept in French, in German, and finally signed it. And then she told me the word in Gaelic. I went, yes, that's the word. But it's, to me, only knowing one language, you may be fluent, you may be eloquent. However, you're missing out, you're losing opportunities, you're losing your own chance at diversity to yeah. know how to express yourself. I studied Arabic for a while. There are such beautiful metaphors which are not in English, mm-hmm. which they don't seem like much, but to be in the mindset of a desert people when water and animals and kinship are everything. You know, it's kind of like being on the planet Dune, right? You know, but to put yourself in that mindset, I watch Turkish television, great production values from Turkey, because it enables me to understand a different mindset, a different philosophy, a mm-hmm. different belief system. I recommend it. I'll be quiet now.
Yeah. Well, this is a perfect time to turn to speaking about writing, because as you're saying this, I'm even thinking about if you go back and study Old English, or if you study, you know, in school, you study Beowulf, read Heart of Darkness, or you study Shakespeare. And yes. if you're performing Shakespeare, you learn, okay, this is what you think it says, but let's go a level deeper. And you can get down about 7 levels to really distill mm-hmm. the essence of what the
yes.
meaning of each
yes.
word is. And that is one of the beautiful things about reading and books and culture. It's a language in a different way, right, than mm-hmm. what the auditory language. So I'd mm-hmm. love now to turn to talking about your second, I don't even know if it's second stage, your 10th stage, your 10th life as a full-time author. And you've been writing, yes. of course, since the same time that you were doing everything else. You've always been a writer.
Yeah. Yes. But, yeah. I sold my first story in 1978. I realized probably before many of your listeners, many of your audience were born, but there goes, you know, gave me a bit of time to practice what I was doing. Yeah, I've always wanted to write, and that comes from my grandfather, the grandfather who raised me for much of my early life. If you want to be technical, he would be called a mystagogue, a Sicilian mystagogue. What that really means is he was the individual in the village who told the old stories,
yeah.
who shared the mysteries, mystagogue. Talk about the mysteries. So he would tell the tales and keep the old stories, the old beliefs alive. And even though we were in this country, all the neighbors would gather around because Giovanni was going to talk about his stuff, you know. And it was great. We're talking the late 1950s now, because his payment for telling these stories, keeping the old stories alive, would be a chicken. Mm. Would be hamburger,
yeah.
would be whatever fish they caught that day, you
yeah.
know? And it was very much a village setting in Everett, Bass.
So, my gosh.
But it was wonderful. I learned pacing from him. I learned storytelling, story crafting. How does each story go together? Do you talk about the character first? Or do you talk about what's happening first? Once upon a time, if there is anything that can push you into the mythic, once upon a time, there was a beautiful woman, and she looked longingly for her prince. Okay, so we know there's two main characters, but one's not in the story. The prince, he's not there. But we know it's going to be a quest.
Right.
A beautiful princess who looked longingly for her prince. We know what she's after. She's after a romance, a relationship. So we know that she's got something missing. Now, if you do your stuff well, the reader or the listener is not like, oh, that means that she's, you know, blah, blah, blah. They're not doing the analysis. They're going, what happens next? What happens next? What happens next? And that was the thing with Grandpa was, people would be in the living room, you know, right, come on. Yeah, what's what? And I remember one time my grandfather, because sometimes the payment would be wine, right?
Yeah.
So we'd all have, I'm 3 years old, I'm getting doused. So we'd be having wine, and my grandfather would go, I'm in the back house. I have to go to the bathroom. No, come on, finish the story first. Well, I got to go to the bathroom. I got to go. So when you have readers or listeners that enthralled, that interested, you know, and he never said to me, this is how you lay out a story, but it was just hearing it, watching people's response. Who paid attention? When did they lose interest? Why did they lose interest? You know, and Grandpa would always say to people, did you like that one? Yeah, but I wish this had happened. And he would, you take their suggestions. It wasn't like, this is the way a story goes. No, okay. And he never said this to me, but one of the things he demonstrated was when you tell a story, number one, you're sharing yourself as you're telling the story. Mm-hmm. You will always share what's important to you in the story. But also, anytime you share, it's a living thing.
Oh, yeah.
It is an agreement between the person listening or reading and the person telling the story. You know, and if I say, have I got a story for you? I better pay off. I better give you something, you know? And I've studied writing, crafting, story crafting, of course. I still do. I'm very actively studying because I'm not about to say my work is perfect. It's pretty good, but not perfect. But it's an evolving process. I always want to know what my readers think, even if they don't like it. That's fine.
Well,
you didn't like it. Because, tell me why, I can make it better.
Interesting.
Oh, okay.
But what your grandfather was also setting the stage for was your work as a data scientist and neuroscientist. And because we always talk about brand storytelling and how are we sharing stories and the neural pathways that are being, the connections that people, the mirroring, people putting themselves in the shoes of the characters as we're telling stories for brands, which is also what you hope to get when you're reading a great story. You want to turn each page and then you want to, into the next one. He was, when you were looking at everybody, you were using, not to get like, you know, wonky, but like qualitative analysis. You were seeing what were the people's reactions.
Yeah.
How many people had that reaction? Quantitative, qualitative. And then, so he set the stage for so many things in life.
Yes.
That is such a beautiful testament to who he must have been.
Yeah. Well, I thought so anyway.
Yeah.
I dedicated a book to him. So, yeah.
So talk about what kind of books do you write? Is it one genre or is it kind of the same? Like you like to play with a lot of different genres? Do you have series of books? What does that journey look like for you?
Well, I tell people and in my biography, it says that I write autobiography. It just gets purchased as science fiction, fantasy, horror, children's stories, poetry, blah, 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 magic realism. And my sister who reads my stuff often says, did we grow up in the same house? You know, but I do rely heavily on my personal experience to write. And I believe every true author, true writer does. Because all we really have to draw on is our own experiences and how we've experienced others and what others have told us about their experiences. There are many, many gifted authors who will write a biography, someone's biography. But what they do, and this is in really good biographies and really good autobiographies, they make the character or themselves very human. They don't, I'm an incredible person and it's amazing what I did. No, they let their humanity come out and that's what makes it interesting.
Exactly.
What they did was fantastic. They're amazing people, but it's how they lived to come up with those things that they did. You know, Barack Obama's journey was an amazing journey, right? He grew up at a point in time where being biracial was not a good thing. And essentially a black child with a white mother, divorced. Wow, that is an amazingly heavy burden to put on a child. And if you ever have a chance, if you ever have an opportunity, read Michelle Obama's book about her first meeting, Barack. And he basically walked into the office, the legal office where she worked for an appointment or something. And he saw her and he began hitting on her, right? And she's like, yeah, right, okay. So he goes to his meeting and all the other people in the office are going like, you know, and we know how that turned out wonderfully.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
So the goal for me has always been to put humanity in the stories. I don't expect everyone to have had the same experiences I've had, but this experience made me very lonely.
Well,
people have felt lonely. Okay. So I don't convey my experience. I share my loneliness and I share how I felt being lonely. You know, you ever have that pain in your chest?
Yeah.
That feels like there's a thousand weights pressing you down, but you have to keep on moving on and you don't know what's coming and you just keep on brushing away the tears. Well, people don't really care about what I did that made me that way. They care about that I survived being that way. And that's the thing. When you're in my case, whether I'm writing science fiction, fantasy, horror, whatever, I want the reader to relate to the character enough that the character's success can be their success, can be a guidepost for them. In one of my novels, The Augmented Man, which is very heavily neuroscience-based, it's about someone recovering from severe PTSD and childhood trauma. The middle section of the book is specifically about the therapy techniques that are used to help this character come out. And I've had professional therapists, psychologists, and people recovering from trauma contact me and say, that was a guidebook. That was a blueprint for what I had to do. When I've done book signings, I've had people come to me and say, that helped me understand my dad, my brother, my wife, my aunt, my cousin, you know, who are coming back from Afghanistan, from wherever, traumatized. Now I understand. Now I know what I can do. My job's done. All right, I'm good. You know what I'm saying? That to me is the biggest blessing than anything else.
I can imagine. So you're writing books. I feel like you're writing them very much for yourself and for the joy that you get out of it and the learning, right, that you get out of it as well, because you're able to explore different parts of yourself, but also different things that you're interested in and weave them in. Which I think could be a little different than a lot of authors. A lot of authors who think about, oh, I need to make X amount of sales, this is my job, and approach it that way. So what does that look like when you go through the writing process? Do you mostly self-publish? Do you have a publisher or publishing houses that you work with? And then what does it look like when you get to the stage where you're promoting it? And what to you is success? Sorry, I know that's like five questions.
But no, that's okay. Success is the easy part, actually. Success to me is... For example, today, when I was giving a talk about writing and just got to the audience and I said, what do you have for questions? Because there was an outline of what I was supposed to talk about. And I went, you know what? What do you want to know? Because that's more important to you than what I want to talk about.
Right.
And we had an hour and a half. It was supposed to be an hour. We stayed for an hour and a half. It was wonderful. That's success. When people say to me, that helped me a lot. Yes. Good. When someone gives me a review, good or bad, it doesn't matter. But when someone is so moved by something I've written to write to others about it, right? To the unknown others. You know, they leave a review on Amazon, Goodreads, BookBub, whatever. That is success. There's also financial success. You know, I'm not going to deny that a nice royalty check is a good thing because everybody has to eat and you have to pay bills. And this is just between you and me. Don't tell your audiences. I have a bad habit of giving away books. If I think someone could benefit from a book, sure, not a problem. Here's a book. Want me to sign it? Sure. Happy to sign it.
Wow.
Leave a review. But success has many flavors. Do I need universal adulation? I had it before when I was in business. It's not all it's cracked up to be. You know, I enjoy a quiet life. I enjoy my wife, my dog. I enjoy the woodlands out behind our house. So that's success. I have had 6 publishers since 2016. And the first 2 books I put out were self-published. One was an anthology of stuff that I'd published back in the days of print that other magazines had said, yeah. And one was a novel I'd been working on. The only thing was, I didn't know how to write at the time. You know, I thought I did, but I didn't. So I took 6 years, and I still had books that I were available. I took 6 years to learn how to write. And I would spend 8, 10, 12 hours a day studying, taking classes, talking with other authors who I respected. And during that time, I went from self-publishing to one publisher who really wanted the Augmented Man. Because I had the business background, I said, would you mind having a Zoom session? I'd like to talk with you, know your background, et cetera, et cetera. In the Zoom session, the publisher threatened me if I didn't give him the book.
What?
Yeah. And I went, okay, thanks. I appreciate your time and this call. That was it. He did send me a follow-up letter restating that I would be very sorry didn't give him the book. Okay, fine. Thank you. I didn't. The next publisher, I asked them when we were negotiating the contract, do you have an author's style guide? And they went, yeah, don't worry about it. Well, I write very specifically and I really choose words. That punctuation is important to me. I write so the reader gets into a rhythm as they read. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Sent them the first manuscript. The first thing was they assigned me an editor who didn't have any knowledge of science fiction or fantasy. So, you know, she's reading a military, science fiction military thriller, and there's a scene where the senior officer is watching the junior officer do something wearing a dress blues. And, you know, one sentence, he appreciated the felt, the cut of the clothes, the way the soldier filled them. She wanted to know if that was a gay scene. And I went, no. And just had a lot of issues like that. But the big issue was I write, I use punctuation, I use colons, semicolons, M dash, very specifically have different pauses in my sentences. That's when they sent me this style guide saying, well, we don't use colons, we don't use apostrophes, we don't use semicolons.
Everything that you do.
Yeah, it's a comma or nothing. So I went, okay. I talked to the editor-in-chief and said, this ain't going to work. And that was a 5-book deal.
Wow.
But I said no. The next publisher came to me wanting the Augmented Man. And contract looked good. Everything looked good. Until after the day after it was signed. And then you guys in the contract that says you're supposed to do this. Well, we'll get to it eventually. Then to find out they never bothered to make a copyright on the novel, but they were giving it away to audiobook producers and everyone else. Mm-hmm. So I was losing out an awful lot of royalties, which they were getting.
Oh, geez.
So basically, 6 publishers, small press, indie. I know there are good ones out there. But when I talk to starting authors and they say, what do you think of the indie? I said, be very careful. Get a good attorney. And instead of saying, oh, wow, someone's going to publish my book, go with your gut. Does this really feel right? Be honest with yourself. Yes, it's wonderful to get published.
Mm-hmm.
But if they say, by the way, we're not going to do any marketing, or if you want us to do marketing, it's going to cost you $10,000, back away.
Yeah.
You can do it a lot less than $10,000. I am with a publishing house now, all cards on the table, Northern Lights Publishing. After six failures and not being able to get a mainstream publisher interested, I had publishers and agents get back to me and say, this is one hell of a book, but I can't put it on my schedule. I wouldn't know where to put it. I can't put it in my marketing plan. It doesn't fit that linear path thing. It doesn't fit that genre. I wouldn't know where to put it on a shelf. Oh, okay. So we had these contacts from the business days, and I reached out and I said, I want to start a publishing house for people like myself. Mm-hmm. Who's going to run it? Susan and I. Okay, fine. Sure. So, we got investments, and we have a staff. They're not getting paid a lot. They're getting paid, as I'm often reminded, where are we going to get royalties soon? I hope to God soon. We haven't turned a profit. It's our first year.
Oh.
However, the royalty curve is going up, which is what you want. And even more important, many of my friends who are authors have said, you can have my book whenever you're ready. And I go, Liz, Jeff, I really appreciate your confidence. Until we know how to turn a profit, I don't want to take your books because they're going to languish. They're going to die. Keep on going after a mainstream publisher. Keep on going after an existing publisher. They at least know something that I don't. So that brings us to marketing. Marketing is the black hole in any business, as you know. I forget who said that. This is back in the 1940s, I think it was 50% of my marketing works, 50% doesn't, but I don't know which is which. And as a neuromarketer, when I was doing neuromarketing, I worked very hard to get companies to apply scientific rigor. And that was very difficult to do in the marketing industry.
Right.
At the time, people were, we don't really keep metrics. Really? Wow. Okay. And I would be able to produce for them all the data and the results from the research and blah, blah, through to this is how we should do it. An anecdote about that. Procter & Gamble called us in. They were releasing one of their product lines, Pampers, internationally. And I said, you have the marketing material? They said, yeah. I said, send it over to me. I'm in the hotel room. I have nothing to do in the morning, right? Before the meeting. So they sent it over to me, and I had that laptop I was talking about. And I ran the marketing material. It analyzed the material. So here we are. I have France, I have England, and I have Finland in Chicago. They're calling in from Europe, but I'm now in the offices in Chicago. And first thing I say is, you're going to do really good in England. You're going to do pretty good in France. You're going to trash out horribly in Finland. What makes you say that? I said, well, while I was having my coffee and my breakfast, I was running an analysis on your marketing campaign.
Yes.
And this marketing will not work in Finland. It does not work. That's not the way Finnish people think. That's not how their language is structured. Mm-hmm. You're going to do great in England because you have people from England developing the campaign. But the translation from English to French isn't working. Those are not the images which ring true for someone in France. Those are definitely not. And they're like, did you talk to somebody before you came in? I said, no, you just gave me your materials. And they said, you nailed it. You got it. We're doing really good in England. Okay, in France, we haven't got a thing in Finland. Here's how you modify it, which is the key, right? And getting them to understand Finnish people, it's a Finno-Ugric language. They do not think the way we do. I don't care if they're in business. I don't care how successful they are. Their inner thought processes are different than ours. You must tap into this to get them to buy that. And it took a while. We eventually worked with Adidas.
Yeah.
Bayer. Bank of Scotland, AT&T, actually it was Verizon. We worked with a lot of large companies, but it always came down to, what is it going to cost you to give this a try? Do a limited engagement. Just do a small test run, what's called the small world study. Wow, it worked really well. Let's expand it. There we go. That's why I say never be successful. Oh, very exhausting. But that was the thing. And of course, that gets back into what we were talking about earlier, storytelling.
Right.
One of my teachers said, if you really want to work with somebody, you got to speak their language.
Mm-hmm.
And that locked in. That was in there really tight. And I mentioned that I have some French, I have some German, I have Gaelic, Italian. But I will pick up bits and pieces wherever I am.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's just the jargon, the slang, you know, because that's significant. If you spend time in England, southern England, they have an expression, which you're having difficulty with something, and you're coming out of it. So you got that all sorted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you get that all sorted? How does that work out for you?
Yeah.
And as such, they just say it. They just drop it in the conversation. But what it tells you is, in the British mindset, there's a progression, sorted. There's this, and then there's this, and there's mm-hmm. this, and then there's this. Did it work out for you? There was a path, and here's the result.
Right.
So if you keep that, something as simple as that, keep that in mind when you're designing marketing for a British, Southern England audience, you're locked in. Give them marketing, which explains to them, this is how it gets sorted out. This is how it gets sorted. Okay, show me how it gets sorted.
Right.
You know, this is how you work it out. Okay, show me that, you know. And even subtleties like Italian is a very gastronomic language.
Ooh.
Everything has a taste and a smell. Oh, my God. French is much more olfactory.
Ooh.
So you can sell something with the same campaign, but just a little bit of tweaking. You're doing great in Italy, a little bit of tweaking. You're doing great in France. We used to help politicians, and a politician came to us and said, I want to do a 30-second video ad. Right, for TV, which is a long time. 30 seconds is a lot of time.
That is a lot of time.
And they said they wanted for the Northeast U.S. audience. I said, okay, fine. And we helped them get that going. Then I said conversationally, you know, if you do a different voiceover, that same ad will work beautifully in the Southeast. What? And I said, yeah, you basically have a narration and you have the principal talking, sharing, okay, their ideas. In the Southeast, just have the video, which is the most expensive part,
right,
of them talking. Don't have to have the voice. Just show them talking, engaging, being with people, and having a narrator explain what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and there you've captured the Southeast. Now, have a few more images of this. You capture the Midwest. So instead of having to create different campaigns, mm-hmm. and they're like, wow, you got to be kidding me. No, it's just knowing how people think, you know? I'm rambling. I apologize.
Oh, my gosh. No apologies needed. It's making me think of, for the 2020 elections, I was working with a group that was just a couple that wanted to encourage people to vote. No politics behind it. So they created 15-second or less snippets for social media, and we did a campaign for people, you know, micro-influencers, anybody who wanted to share the campaign could get paid to share it on their socials. And we did retool it a little bit once the election was over, and then we focused on getting people to vote for the Georgia Senate runoff. We retooled a little bit because we worked with local organizations in Georgia to make sure, because we knew the rate of Indigenous Americans who voted was lower. And so mm-hmm. we wanted to encourage them to go, you know, so we picked out different populations and different partners, and we did use imagery that was germane for them.
Yeah.
For it. But it was, everything else was the same. Like you said, we just swapped out a couple of things, but it was really great because we did get anecdotal evidence that, yeah, I wasn't going to vote. And then I was on social and I saw my friend post this and I said, oh, something in that sparked me to realize that I did matter and that my vote would count and that I should go vote.
Good.
So those little tweaks can make such a big difference.
And, you know, again, bringing it around, putting in those little touches, if you know your audience, you know your audience is primarily science fiction, military science fiction, fantasy science fiction, speculative science, horror science, whatever, that are what are called tropes,
mm-hmm.
you know, things which, I'm reading a horror story, I have to have a ghoul in here or something. What you really need is something that makes the person feel nervous, feel
right.
minor, feel a little afraid. It doesn't have to be a ghoul. As a matter of fact, you know, Stephen King, if you look at analyze Stephen King's writing,
mm-hmm.
he begins five or six pages before the ghoul, whatever, shows up, putting in little drops, changing the language slightly. And he does it so beautifully, you know, and until finally, when the whatever is revealed, you're jumping out of your seat. Because he's put you slow. It's kind of like in the original movie, The Alien.
Mm-hmm.
You heard the alien.
Yeah.
You never saw the alien. You saw what the alien did, you know. So when the alien was finally revealed, oh my God, you know. And I don't know if you remember, the people who saw Alien for the first time, when the alien was finally revealed, all the popcorn went flying, all the drinks went flying. They were, oh my God. It was kind of like a reverse of a Rocky Horror Picture Show where you waited for the thing. Yeah, and you threw the popcorn. You know, if you didn't cover yourself with plastic, you were an idiot. Anyway, I'm old. What can I tell you?
I'm older than I look. So what do you see as your next phase? You're going to continue writing. Your book publishing company is pretty new, so you're going to keep expanding it.
Yep. Yep. We're working very hard. We're actively studying a variety of marketing techniques, you know. And the thing is, as I'm sure you're aware, when you study marketing, different vectors, you go, this piece here, it's kind of like when I was putting that technology again. This piece here is really, that happens, that works.
Yeah.
But the rest of it doesn't. Mm-hmm. This piece works. Can the two of those two together? How much can they go together? You know, how do they work together? So it's very much experimental, but I've been a researcher a lot of my life. So, okay, you know, this is an interesting thing. That will go as long as we have pennies to put in the pocket, you know, basically. My next venture as an author, I'm always writing something. I have, you know, I was out today, so I had all sorts of notes on my phone that I have to transcribe in. I have a little recorder on the bedstand, and I try so hard to be very quiet in the middle of the night. And then they said this in the morning. Susan says, "So what was the note you were talking about?" I'm like, "Oh, sorry, dude." The story that I'm currently working on, I thought it was going to be a murder mystery. No, it's a mystery, but not necessarily a murder mystery.
Yeah.
A murder does occur, but it's by accident. Didn't mean to happen. The next story, it's a toss-up. Not long ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I had this really vivid thing about a policewoman and a guy who falls in love with her. Mm-hmm. I've never written a romance. I've never written what you'd call a chick lit.
Mm-hmm.
But I was driving and I pulled over on the side of the road and I spent 10 minutes just dictating scenes that came to me as I was there into my phone. When I got home, I have a weekly meeting with an editor and she said, "So what have you been working on?" And I mentioned this story and I'm telling her the scenes and she starts crying. She says, "That's the most beautiful thing I've ever read, ever heard."
Wow.
I went, "Wow, good. I think, thank you. When are you going to write that?" "Oh, it's not for a while yet. I'm kind of letting it concentrate my head." But I always have many projects going. Somebody made the mistake of saying, how many things are you working on? I went through my list and I said, "You don't want to know, it's a lot." But I would like to believe that I continue to grow as a writer, that my craft continues to grow. My regular readers, and I take this as a compliment, because I will say to them, "Where does this book go? Is this fantasy? Is this horror? Where does this book go?" And they'll say, "No, your genre is Joseph. I don't have to see your name on a cover. I can tell by the way it's written. It's you wrote it."
Wow.
Now, recognize that's excellent branding, rotten marketing.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, because you're your own brand, Joseph. Nobody writes the way you do. Good. Good. No, not really. Because eventually you have to put it on a shelf. You have to put it on a, you know, this is where these books are found. But I'm always going to be writing something, and it will always be whatever catches my interest.
Mm-hmm.
The policewoman and the guy who falls in love, Richie and Phil, A Celebration of Life. I don't know where that came from. I honest to God, I don't. I literally stopped at a traffic light and I turned over here to see the traffic coming, and there it was. There's a whole story arc.
But they say that ideas, I'm not going to get this correct, but ideas jump, right? If something's coming up in you and you don't act on it, it's going to find the next person who is going to act on it. So it sounds like that happened to you, and you are saying, and you are now the stakeholder. You're the one who you're saying, yes, I am going to take this story and put it out into the world.
Yes. Yes. An interesting thing about ideas jumping, if you don't take it, the next person. I was very fortunate to meet the evangelist Billy Graham. When he was alive, of course, that's the best way to meet him. And he was talking to a group of us. And I don't honestly remember how we got on this subject. But he said that he was positive God actually had someone else chosen. And I'm not a religious person. I don't want you to think I'm a spiritual person or anything like that. But he said he actually believed that God had chosen somebody else to become essentially Billy Graham. And that person said no, some or other. And he said he's always recognized he was God's second choice. And I'm like, whoa, wow. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but whoa. To recognize that or to accept that and be comfortable with it, and to just say, I'm going to do the best I can. Isn't that what we're all supposed to be doing?
Yeah.
Regardless of where we think we are, we're all supposed to be, I'm going to do the best I can for myself, for others, for those I love, for people I meet, right?
Exactly. You know? Well, and we didn't even get into some of the topics that you had shared with me that you like to cover. Healing, emotional health, consciousness, spiritual well-being. But we'll have to come back for another episode to unpack those topics. But what I'm really hearing from your story, what I'm really taking away, is that we shouldn't be afraid to walk our own paths. And so many times, like, we are so afraid of taking the chance on ourselves because we think, oh, but I'm not going to have enough money. We have all the reasons not to do it, not to progress in our minds and the physical manifestation of it, or the family behind us that is telling us to be cautious. But what you're saying is, be unfettered, be free, live, explore, dream, do, be.
Yes.
Because then we can all have a brilliant, amazing experience with our time here, the way that you and your wife have.
Yes. I think this is actually something from David Bowie, who was one of my heroes, is brilliant. I would rather have gone through life knowing I attempted and failed than knowing I wish I had and never attempted. And this from David Bowie, you know, who, you talk about a musical chameleon, right? You know, he did jazz, he did blues, he did rock, he did orchestral. Is there something you haven't done, Dave? You know, he was an actor, you know, he wrote plays, really. And what was his origin? What was his beginning? Humble, right? He wasn't born into wealth and power. And he never said, I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. Now, the funny thing is, you ask him, I didn't ask him, but in the interviews, was there stuff you wanted to do that you didn't do? I never went motorcycle racing across the Baja. I was afraid. Did you really miss that you didn't do that? No, I was too afraid. Oh, okay. I give you that one.
Yeah.
For me, it's getting on a parachute. No, I'm good. That's okay. I like the ground. Ground is good.
Fantastic.
So, yes, be willing to make mistakes. That's how we learn.
Yeah.
We learn, you know?
Joseph, what is, because there are a lot of places people can find you, and I am chuckling at your LinkedIn because how many sales calls, people who reach out and say, oh, I just want to make a new connection. I see we do something similar, and then they try to sell you. So I love that right front and center. You said, don't sell me anything. Don't try to reach out because you want me to buy whatever you're, you know. So thank you for that. But what is the number one place? Would you like people to go to your website? Do you want them to find you on LinkedIn? Do they want, you want them to go to your socials?
Find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. You know, look for me on Amazon.com. Feel free to reach out to me. I think of myself as very approachable. You know, you mentioned the LinkedIn thing where I have, don't pitch me. Don't reach out to me just to pitch me. There's one fellow, Dante, He and I have only been corresponding about 2 or 3 days, but I said right up front, he reached out to me. I said, don't pitch me. And he said, I'm not interested in pitching. I'm just fascinated that you're an author.
Hey.
And we've been corresponding through LinkedIn to the point where, okay, he's a real person. He's got a life. He's not a salesman. So I looked at his profile in full. I read through it in detail. And then I go, Dante, I understand that you coach people on health, on well-being, on exercise. Yep. Okay. What can you do with a 68-year-old author? You know, because he's gained my trust. He's gained my respect. Again, marketing, right?
Yeah.
You know, that was another thing that I really encourage people to do. Pay attention to master salespeople.
Boom.
They don't sell you the product. They sell you themselves.
Okay.
They get you their trust. They let you know it's okay. They don't try to sell you. They find out what you want, what you need, what you like, and they let you ask. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all together.
It is. And I know you gave a really fantastic quote, but I always ask if you have a favorite quote or mantra. So do you have another one that you'd like to share with us?
The one that comes to mind, first came to mind, is I journey to the great perhaps.
Ooh.
It's much better in French, but I journey to the great perhaps, which in the original French, the meaning is I go where I don't know, because that's how I explore. That's, you know, the great perhaps. What's here? What is there?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, you know, and what we were talking about just a few moments ago, always be exploring, be reading, be listening, you know, find what you like and do it, because there's so many people who are not doing what they like, and it's affecting their lives, their family, their children, their animals. You know, even if it's bowling, I'm not a bowler, but even if, you know, go bowling once a week with some friends, you know, just to do something different. And don't be afraid to do gutter balls all the time.
Yeah.
You know, because that's part of learning.
Beautiful. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you.
I am looking forward to having more conversations with you.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
Digging into your books and getting my daughter to them and all that. So, Joseph, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Absolutely. And thank you to my audience for coming back for another episode, whether you're watching it or listening to it on any number of podcast platforms, on 360 Talk Radio for Women, on Traverse TV streaming platform. We appreciate you being here. Don't forget to give a follow, a like, a review. They really mean a lot to me and to my guests. And I'll be back again in a few days with another amazing story to help you figure out your life, and whether it's your work life, your personal life, or everything, everywhere.
Want more? Check out amplifywithannika.com or follow me on socials at @AmplifyWithAnnika.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at
As we close out today's episode, I want to thank Simplified again for making it possible. For all marketers and creators out there, Simplified is your ally in effortlessly crafting on-brand content with a design and video AI. Discover how AI can enhance your creative process at simplify.com. Start for free and elevate your content game. Thanks for listening, and here's to your next creative breakthrough.